Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you live from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to you in Bristol and also to our listeners in Preston and those all over the world accessing the show over the internet. We've invited last week's studio guest Michael Doble to come back again because they were so good onto this week's show.
Michael Doble is chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society. Chatterton was considered by many to be England's first and finest romantic poet. Malcolm Greaves will be reading Chatterton's great poetry, as well as reading this week's instalment, as ever, of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire in the 1920s.
And John says, as ever, but there's only a few more episodes left until the end of the diary, so listen up. And the ever-reliable Jeff Sparks brings us his weekly What's On and the Song of the Week. I'm Katie Austin.
And I'm John Peters Coleman. Well, I'd like to welcome now to the studio Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, BSc, brackets, ONS, AM, INST, LM. Hello.
Good evening. Those aren't all my qualifications, actually. I couldn't fit them all on the card, so I had to truncate it just to those two in great modesty.
Oh, good Lord. What's AM, INST, LM?
Associate member of the Institute of Leadership and Management.
Good heavens. And you're here to talk once again. This is part two of two, chat about the life of Thomas Chatterton. Mm-hmm. Last week we touched on a lot of his early life, particularly his family life, his strong connection to the church. His ancestors all worked in the church for about 150 years. Now, you did say you got kicked out of school last week, but you said you got that slightly wrong. What age did you get kicked out?
Yes, I made a mistake there. I moved the decimal point one position in the wrong direction, and he was 6 years of age, not 16 years of age, that he was ejected from school as a dullard incapable of improvement.
Okay.
But it was more a case of the teachers weren't able to experience and comprehend and appreciate his genius and his wayward daydreaming about his ideas and so on, rather than him being not very bright.
Okay. And just remind us, how much poetry, for example, the works he wrote in the guise of a 15th century monk, using a lot of sort of ancient language and even words that he made up himself, how much did he manage to write in about, what was it, 18 months when he was about 16, 17?
A total canon of approximately 680 pages in 18 months, yeah. And that compares very favourably with, say, William Wordsworth, who wrote 950 pages in 67 years.
Now, he was beloved by the Romantic poets. I mean, to what extent do you think his supposedly sort of tragic death, his suicide, plays a part in this romantic image and him later being taken up? And if he just lived to a ripe old age, do you think he would be considered as such a sort of romantic genius figure?
That's a very interesting question. I think that the fact that he died so tragically and so young did help to promote the myth of the romantic neglected genius who took his own life because no one appreciated his worth at that time during his own lifetime. But in reality, irrespective of that myth, the work was truly appreciated for the work in itself by the great poets that came afterwards. Blake, Coleridge, Shelley, Byron, Wordsworth, all of them appreciated the work for what it was.
Yeah.
Although they may have been influenced by his tragic death. And one aspect of the myth which I find a little frustrating is that, well, two things. I don't really believe it was a suicide. He was too large in life. I don't believe a person possessed of that genius is interested in negating the genius and killing himself. He's interested in expanding and delivering his genius upon the world.
Yeah.
He's too involved in life.
But he could be very, he could have been very impulsive. I mean,
let's put it this way. If you look at the actual evidence, he wrote home many letters just before his death to various people, and he had lots of plans. He had plans to do a history of England. He had plans to go travel abroad. He had plans for plays and poems and things, and was very committed to his immediate future. It would be unusual for someone to be writing and thinking in that way and then a week later to kill themselves.
Yeah, this is all reminding me very uncannily of David Kelly, which more later in the show. But I mean, so as far as his legacy as the suicide goes, I mean, there's quite a long gap between his death and him being picked up and suddenly regarded as a legend. How big a gap are we talking about between him really coming into the public consciousness as this sort of genius figure?
Well, we're looking at, it depends on who you take as the first person to really appreciate him, but you're looking at a generation, from 1770 towards the end of the century, to the turn of the century.
Right. What would you consider to be Chesterton's greatest work?
Well, from a personal standpoint, I like so much of his work. He writes beautiful eclogues, he writes wonderful satire, very clever, witty sketches. His Rowley work, of course, is marvellous. But what's considered by critics generally to be his greatest work is Elia, which is a play of 1,400 lines approximately, and it's very clever. It's got beautiful measures and meters and rhyme, and it tells the story of a classical play, if you like, of that period of heroism, love, betrayal, death, the normal sort of classic.
Very sort of, sounds quite Shakespearean.
Yes, it was. I mean, it would rank amongst Shakespeare's plays. A lot of critics consider Elia to be as good as plays of Shakespeare.
I mean, it all sounds quite fantastical for a sort of a boy so young. You know, he's not even 20 yet, to be sort of writing this fantastic amount of stuff. I mean, a lot of people, understandably, will probably wish to think that a lot of this stuff must be forgeries because it's so fantastical. I mean, a lot of people seem to, there are a lot of allegations that his work was forged and his story isn't really real, isn't really.
Yes, that was a consideration initially, that they must have been forged, because the people who were analysing them were primarily people from a very privileged backgrounds who had classical education at Cambridge University and so on, mm-hmm. studied the classics, knew Latin, Greek, etc. And they couldn't accept that a poor charity boy who was born 3 months after his father's death had little or no education, and certainly absolutely no classical education, could possibly write such wonderful poetry.
That's quite understandable by the sounds of what I'm saying.
It is, but the same question might be put to them is, well, what about Shakespeare? You see, what we know of Shakespeare is that he didn't have a particularly classical education and he was poor. But the truth of it is this, irrespective of the environment that Chatterton was born into and what sort of background he had and so on, education, etc., if you look at the internal evidence, if you actually study the structure of what was written, they must have been written by Chatterton because of the nature of them. It's not possible that they could be forgeries because they were unique to him. They were unique to his creation, his creativity. And so I think he was called a forger primarily because, I think, in a way, because of professional jealousy, and people just couldn't understand how such a person could write such material. And you see, he didn't help himself by being such a clever satirist. You see, if you write really biting satire against the greatest literary men of the day, such as Samuel Johnson, and you write very, very clever biting satire against King George III, Horace Walpole, that's the 4th Earl of Orford, other people, then it's not doing you a lot of good.
No. I mean, there is definitely a common personality to all of his work.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Identifiable as to one belonged to one.
That's right. If you actually analyse it, you can see it's come from one mind, one creativity. If you look at the modern eclogues against the Rowley ones, you can see that they are the same writer. And the interesting thing is, not only did he write verse in 15th century idiom, he wrote right back to Saxon times,
right.
The 11th century and so on. There are about half a dozen or thereabouts poets that he claimed wrote this work, but they're spread over about 4 centuries and they're all of his creation.
There are a lot of romantic poets of the 19th century revered him. Where does he? What sort of influence does he have on more modern poets? I mean, my knowledge of poetry is fairly limited, but I mean, I've read sort of Seamus Heaney, Andrew Motion, Louis MacNeice, a variety of 20th century people. I mean, where does his influence sit in with more modern people?
Well, his influence goes right through the Victorian period to at least to Oscar Wilde and Siegfried Sassoon and so on. But I think perhaps more latterly of contemporary poets, his influence is not as great as it might be. I wouldn't want to cast aspersions upon modern poets, but you see, Chatterton was a truly, truly great poet. And I think the problem with art today, generally, is that we're all in too much of a hurry. Everything has to be done as quickly as possible. And it's my personal view that, generally speaking, in the arts, the craftsmanship that used to be applied across all the art forms is less so stringently applied in art forms today.
Mm.
And I would be interested to put the challenge out to any poet in the world today to match Chatterton on, say, his prosody in The Battle of Hastings II in terms of the structure of the stanzas and the longevity of it. Battle of Hastings II is the classical Rowley measure, which is iambic pentameters on 10 lines, rhyming with two interlocking quatrains and completing on a couplet. Now, try to keep that up for 720 lines. It's not easy. Four rhymes on 10 lines for 720 lines in an iambic pentameter, that's 10 syllables. And occasionally, he ends on an alexandrine, which is 12 syllables. And if you go back even further to Edmund Spenser and read, say, The Faery Queen, which is the longest poem in the English language,
right,
that's 9 lines on 3 rhymes, and it's 4,060 stanzas.
How many people do you ever think of actually made it to
lines?
The
well, not many people today.
He had quite a lot of time on his hands then.
He was a great poet.
Okay, fair enough.
And he wrote a long poem.
Time is sort of drawing on, but I mean, he grew up, of course, in the cottage on the way to the main railway station here, opposite St. Mary Redcliffe Church. It's looking a little bit sort of bedraggled and anonymous. There is a blue plaque on it. I mean, what do you think would you like to be seen in Bristol to represent him and show off to people?
I think that's a very, very interesting question, and it's something I've been working with the Bristol City Council for some time on.
Mm-hmm.
And what we would like to do is to turn it into a museum to Thomas Chatterton and a visitor centre. But unlike, say, the models of literary visitor centres that have been built in the past, they're quite old now, of course. If you look at say Dove Cottage, which is Wordsworth, and Coleridge's cottage in Nether Stowey.
Yes.
They're very interesting and very informative, but they're somewhat static because they simply have some books, a quill, a bottle of ink, and a desk, and this is where he wrote his poems, and the atmosphere is quite interesting and enlightening, but there's no dynamicism, nothing really happens much there.
Right.
So what we would like to do, generally speaking, in the house opposite the church where Thomas Chatterton was born, is to make it into a dynamic, interactive visitor's centre. So not just promote poetry, but promote the arts generally, and have vignette theatres there, for them to be filmed and broadcast over the web, to have synergistic links with the global brand name hotels that are nearby, to encourage visitors, to encourage inward investment, and to encourage people to appreciate just what a great poet Chatterton was, and this is his birthplace, Bristol, and not only that, but the broader picture of the literati who have been in Bristol. We've produced some significant poets and literary figures. Robert Southey, poet laureate. People don't realise it, but he popularised the Three Bears, that lovely children's book. Coleridge was married here with Southey. They married the same sisters in St. Mary Redcliffe Church.
Okay.
Wordsworth and Coleridge both lived at Nether Stowey. And it was at Nether Stowey that he wrote The Rime of the Ancient Mariner and so on. Byron, his wife, with a friend, set up a dame school in the Red Lodge, which is just off Park Street.
Okay.
We have other poets such as Hannah Moore, the social reformer and poet, Anne Yearsley. So there's quite a nucleus there that could be built on to make it into a literary and artistic centre. When you look at, say, Edinburgh, before they started the Edinburgh Festival, no one thought of Edinburgh as being particularly, with all respect to Edinburgh, cultural. All it needed was a few people with a good idea and a lot of determination to make it happen.
Absolutely. So, I mean, especially considering when you exit the station, approach at Templemead Station, I mean, that house is potentially one of the first places that you come across.
Absolutely.
Apart from that horrible hotel that you look at. It's not particularly pleasant, but, you know, I mean, that certainly could be one of the first stop-off points for anybody visiting Bristol.
So it's that's
a bit of
right.
A shame that you go straight past it and don't see anything.
Absolutely. It would be an ideal stop-off point on the Brunel Mile, as they're thinking of, to stop off and visit see his birthplace and perhaps watch a nice play about Chatterton or read a book about him and buy some postcards and do all these normal things.
All right. Well, does the Thomas Chatterton Society have any sort of web presence, or how can people get in contact with you or get more involved?
We have a website. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you Google Thomas Chatterton Society, it will come up immediately.
Brilliant.
I would like, if I may, to end on a quotation that summarises Chatterton.
Yeah.
And because I think it's very powerful. We talk about his poetry and his prosody and so on, but this takes it from a global view, shall we say.
Okay.
So this was by Henry J. Jennings. Chatterton. We look in vain through the annals of biography for a parallel story. There is none so strange. Like some dazzling meteoric light, he burst upon the startled gaze of the literary world, flashed forth his luminous radiance for a brief moment of transitory splendour, and then vanished into the utmost darkness of an early tomb, leaving the world in dumbstruck, lost wonder. Henry J. Jennings, 1868, biographer. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
An extract from The Death of Niku, an African eclogue by Thomas Chatterton. On Tiber's banks, Tiber, whose waters glide in slow meanders down to Gigra's side, and circling all the horrid mountain round, rushes impetuous to the deep profound, rolls o'er the ragged rocks with hideous yell, collects its waves beneath the earth's vast shell. There for a while in loud confusion hurled, it crumbles mountains down and shakes the world, till, borne upon the pinions of the air, through the rent earth, the bursting waves appear. Fiercely propelled, the whitened billows rise, break from the cavern, and ascend the skies. Then lost, and conquered by superior force, through hot Arabia holds its rapid course. On Tiber's banks, where scarlet jasmines bloom and purple aloes shed a rich perfume, where when the sun is melting in his heat, the reeking tigers find a cool retreat, bask in the sedges, lose the sultry beam, and wanton with their shadows in the stream. On Tiber's banks, by sacred priests revered, where, in the days of old, a god appeared. 'Twas in the dead of night at Chalmers' feast, the tribe of Alra slept around their priest. He spoke, as evening thunder bursting near, his horrid accents broke upon the ear. Attend, Al-Radas, with your sacred priest. This day the sun is rising in the east, the sun which shall illumine all the earth. Now is rising in a mortal birth. He vanished like a vapour of the night, and sunk away in a faint blaze of light. Swift from the branches of the holy oak, horror, confusion, fear and torment broke. And still, when midnight trims her mazy lamp, they take their way through Tiber's watery swamp. An extract from Ethelgar, a Saxon poem by Thomas Chatterton. 'Tis not for thee, O man, to murmur at the will of the Almighty. When the thunders roar, the lightnings shine on the rising waves, and the black clouds sit on the brow of the lofty hill, who then protects the flying deer, swift as a sable cloud, tossed by the whistling winds, leaping over the rolling floods, to gain the hoary wood, whilst the lightnings shine on his chest, and the wind rides over his horns. When the wolf roars, terrible as the voice of the Severn, moving majestic as the nodding forests on the brow of Michelstow, who then commands the sheep to follow the swain, as the beams of light attend upon morning? No, O man, that God suffers not the least member of his work to perish without answering the purpose of their creation. Æthelgar stood terrible as the mountain of Maendip. The waves of despair harrowed up his soul as the Severn ploughs the sable sand. Wild as the evening wolf, his eyes shone like the red vapours in the valley of the dead. Horror sat upon his brow. Like a bright star shooting through the sky, he plunged from the lofty brow of the hill, like a tall oak breaking from the roaring wind. St. Cuthbert appeared in the air. The black clouds fled from the sky. The sun gilded the spangling meadows. The lofty pine stood still. The violets of the vale gently moved to the soft voice of the wind. The sun shone on the bubbling brook. The saint, arrayed in glory, caught the falling mortal. As the soft dew of the morning hangs upon the lofty elm, he bore him to the sandy beach, whilst the sea roared beneath his feet.
Our next feature is by a voice that will ring a few bells with you, Anthea Page. It's a feature on bell ringing and the bell ringers of St. Mary Redcliffe Church, where Chatterton wrote many of his poems.
At the belfry to interview the campanologist, is that the right word?
Yes, it is.
And it's a very narrow, rather dark staircase. Well, this is absolutely fascinating. I'm sitting in the middle of a circle of people, probably about 15 to 20 people, and they're all pulling on the bell ropes. Standing just outside the ringing chamber with the...
I'm the ringing master of St. Mary Redcliffe.
And can you tell us a bit about bell ringing?
Well, it's a hobby that's been going on since probably the 15th century. And there's a ring of bells in Ipswich which have just been redone, and they're 500 years old, and they're the original bells with the original clappers. And it was on BBC News about a month ago. So it's been going for about 500 years. There have been bells here since the 17th century, and the present ring date from 1903. It takes a fair time to learn, and these are some of the best bells in the country, alongside York Minster, Westminster Abbey, St. Paul's Cathedral, and other cathedrals which have similar sort of bells.
Could you take us through some of the names of the methods it's called?
We start by ringing rounds, which is starting with the highest noted bell, which is called the treble, which goes then through to the lowest note, which is the tenor. So you have the highest to the lowest, which is 12 bells. There are churches with 8, which is a true octave, and that's called rounds. And then we do things called call changes, which mean you just call someone to go over a different bell. So say the fourth is going over the third, you tell him or her to go over the fifth, the next bell to them. You have a conductor who actually tells you what to do. But then as you become more advanced, you ring methods like grand syncs, Stedman syncs, Aaron syncs, which is on 11, with the tenor, the 12th, going bong at the end, like a full stop. And then as you become more advanced, you ring on all 12, all of them interchanging, and we ring methods such as Cambridge and Yorkshire and Bristol. Now, those are quite advanced methods, and it takes a good 5, 6, 7 years before you could ring Bristol.
Tell us about wedding bells, because that's probably what most people associate with the churches.
Most people, when they get married here, or any church, if there are bells, will ask for the organ, the choir, and the bells. We will ring for half an hour for to celebrate their wedding, the marriage.
Is there any particular method?
No, we will ring what we have the band for. So if we have a strong band, we might ring Yorkshire. If we have a weaker band, we might ring Stedman or Grancer.
And where did the name Sync come from?
Well, if you have five bells, it's called doubles. And doubles means two, obviously. With five bells, doubles means two bells swap, or two pairs of bells swap each time. Triples is on 7, and therefore you get three pairs swapping each time you ring. So syncs means, so I've gathered, syncs means you get 5 pairs, or 10 bells, swapping each time, each change.
Right, I think I've got that. Sounds very mathematical. Now, in the ringing chamber, there's some plaques on the wall to commemorate very special occasions. Can you just take us through some of those?
That peel board was 1835, so that's getting on for 180 years ago. It's history here forever. We ring things called peels, and a complete peel is 5,040 different changes on 12. So you will ring 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. That's one change. We will ring 5,040 different changes, and then it'll come back. The 5,040th change will be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, back to where you started. And that's called a complete peel, and that on these bells will last about 3 hours and 50 minutes. And we ring them for special occasions, so for funerals, deaths of royalty, celebrating the visit of Princess Anne. She came here for the 500th anniversary of the church. So we ring peels also just for fun. We've got the coronation peel. That was for about 3 hours 42 minutes. 3 hours 42 minutes in 1953.
Funeral.
King Edward, for King Edward the Seventh. Yes.
It said muffled bells. How do you muffle them?
You put a piece of leather on the actual clapper, and normally we ring half muffled for Remembrance Sunday, last Sunday in November, and then we also ring for Good Friday half muffled. But when it's someone royal who's died, we then fully muffle them, putting a leather thing on each side of the clapper, so when it hits the bell, you get a more muffled sound. It's much more mournful. The steeplekeeper, Keith over there, he will put the leathers on, and then we come and ring them.
So what about Christmas? Do you have special bells at Christmas?
Yes, we hope to ring Christmas Eve before the midnight service and Christmas morning as well. So for those sort of things, we will hopefully ring all the bells. Can I just start them?
Okay, sorry.
Russell, we're going to ring Francis again.
Standing on a box, that bell ringer?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. Because the biggest bells have some very big wheels, which means that you get rather a lot of rope between the sally, which is the fluffy bit, and the tail end. So if he wasn't standing on a box, you get a great big coil of rope on the floor underneath, which would be difficult to manage. Also, it also damages the rope banging on the floor too much.
We all know our starts in front.
That was Anthea Page in the bell ringing chamber at St Mary Redcliffe. It's time now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. In 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr John Fothergill moved, with his family, to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and the customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or what he was used to, and so he wrote about these experiences in a diary.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. The Commercial's Handshake. Commercial travellers, poor devils, are taught, apparently, to shake hands on arrival as one of the means of ingratiating themselves. Some of ours have had very big and damp hands, and they're offered to Kate as well as to me. But Kate, some time ago, invented an excellent smoke screen. When the good man is seen coming in, or when called to see him, she plucks up an armful of books, or the week's washing, or any other embarrassment, and marches to meet him, sorry that her hands are full. Today I saw Messrs. Blank's little man coming, of good address, and a nice young man, but he will shake hands. So I warned Kate, and in he came. She, with a sheaf of letters and papers in each hand, and I, a cardboard box in my arms containing nothing at all, advanced so as to meet him. But the comedy turned instantly pathetic, because he found no hands of ours in which he could press the little Christmas offering presented by the firm, an enormous handkerchief box in black velvet, Japanese landscape stamped, containing a dozen handkerchiefs on a false bottom, pushed up from below by a high collar of cardboard and glue. Three staying 10 days here now are a girl called Dora Joan Layton, petite but very handsome, and her young fiancé Kennedy, of romantic Scot, who hopes to make agricultural history in Ireland, and their gooseberry, Doreen Crawford, a charming, youthful trio, all looking so cheerful and hopeful, in contrast to a poor, washed-up lady just gone who stayed indoors reading, or leaving about, D.H. Lawrence, and believes that people's sexual relationships are not open enough. Hence all those tears. I wish my book, Faded Fig Leaves, sold as well as Lawrence. The Law Courts. A man and woman came for the weekend. The following evening the lady announced herself as the sister of a friend of mine, and that they were on their honeymoon, which I said was obvious, and we made friends. There was also, for the second night, a single man, elderly, of a class that puzzled me. Not commercial, not colonel. He tried to make himself nice, but in doing so said all the wrong things. You must be busy on market days. Many tourists pass through in summer. Where were you before this? Is this house very old? To all of which, my answer was no. I was rather startled when next morning he and the bridegroom met me outside and introduced themselves as ex-Scotland Yard Inspector A.B., now private detective, and the bridegroom as not married, but having been tracked down and caught as correspondent. The detective told me afterwards that having noted her shoes on her feet in the evening and then outside their door, he went into their room in the morning, when they were in bed, and introduced himself. Would there be no countercharge possible for this most damnable intrusion by an unofficial civilian into one's lawful privacy? The couple were very nice about having let me in for this. They plainly didn't know they were being followed yet. And they gave me afterwards a delightful Victorian woolwork picture, which now on the wall looks down upon the scene of their discomfiture. We had to give evidence in court later. And in spite of the dreariness of it all, I must confess to have felt rather small fry, as proprietor of a country inn, over against a well-known London hotel, where so big is their business in this line that they would seem to have a specially constitutioned man who works as porter by night and attends the court by day. He was up and down in the box most of the time, with the identical story. On that day, a man prayed for and got a divorce from his wife, having discovered after 20 years that she was his aunt, though an illegitimate one, and the prayer book was produced and cited in his support. Existence is a mood. 50 times a day I puzzle about existence. I cannot even begin to ask the question why or where or for how long, because existence itself is a question. I see people all around laughing and smiling and sitting, apparently comfortably, on their bottoms. This must be because I'm overworked, for existence is no problem, of course, when we are at par. When we are normal, we don't trouble about God. Subnormal, we bother, And when supernormal, our souls and bodies are reduced together into a sort of jelly of utter thanksgiving. John Gielgud cheered me today by saying he knew no hotel in England that approached this within measurable distance. It's true, of course, but you don't expect people to feel and know that as keenly as I do myself. Prepare to meet. I offered some Turkish delight to a pretty girl. I put it on a Sunderland lustre plate, with the words, "Prepare to meet thy God." At first sight she looked a little frightened. Then she suddenly lightened up and said, "And a very nice way of being prepared." And once, an estimable young parson called Mortimer irritated me by arguing with me, for the edification of his party, that blanquette of veal was a dull dish. I tried to defend it, at least my own blanquette, but he argued me out of the room. So after dinner, I put down before him Turkish delight, on this "Prepare to meet thy God" plate, neatly arranged around the inscription, a suggestion that he would be better occupied thus than in arguing about blanquette.
Thank you, Malcolm. You can hear another instalment next week.
Well, as we mentioned last week, Bristol was recently the venue for an extraordinary conference. Alternative View 3 showcased about 15 challenging speakers from around the world. One of the most powerful speakers was Liberal Democrat MP for Lewis and Sussex, Norman Baker. It took a year out from the Lib Dem front bench to research and write a book about the so-called suicide of David Kelly, just before the illegal invasion of Iraq, of the government weapons inspector, David Kelly. In it, he proves beyond reasonable doubt that Thames Valley Police failed in their duty, that the government scientist respected around the world for his peacemaking efforts was indeed murdered.
We then had a Hutton inquiry. The Hutton inquiry was set up following the death of David Kelly, officially to look into the circumstances surrounding the death of David Kelly, to which obviously I'll return in a lot of detail in a moment. But what Lord Hutton did with his inquiry was to spend the time discussing whether or not the BBC was at fault for the situation which has arisen, including David Kelly's death, or whether it was in some way the government. And surprise, surprise, Lord Hutton concluded that the BBC was guilty of everything and the government was guilty of nothing. It was the most disgraceful so-called inquiry, I think, in this country's history. So disgraceful was it that when we had the results published in January 2004, it forced the resignation of Greg Dyke, the Director General of the BBC, Gavin Davis, the Chairman of the BBC, Andrew Gilligan, the reporter who had been involved in the story, and led to that spontaneous demonstration of BBC staff as they walked out of Television Centre and stood there defending Greg Dyke in a manner which reminded me of nothing so much as the Prague Spring of 1968 in Czechoslovakia. It was the nadir for the BBC. And then we had the vomit-inducing sight of Richard Ryder, the BBC's number two to the Director General, coming out to make the most obsequious apology to the government for what the BBC had allegedly done. What the BBC had done was report the facts. That's what they'd done. There was a marginal error in Andrew Gilligan's report, but essentially the report which caused so much fuss when he reported that the dossiers had been sexed up. That report was essentially correct. But all those people at the BBC resigned. Nobody from the government resigned over the Iraq war. Nobody. Not the Prime Minister, not the Foreign Secretary, not the Defence Secretary. Nobody. That's the kind of country we have to live in at the moment, and this is why this is unfinished business. We cannot ever allow again a government to behave in that way and to get away with it. And the Chilcot inquiry gives an opportunity at least to bring in political terms that was responsible for that desperate period to book. But then when that report was published in January 2004, and it was clearly so far wrong that it generated ridicule and disbelief in equal measure from the public at large, I wondered if he was so wrong on the issue of the BBC versus the government, whether he was actually right on David Kelly. Because David Kelly, whose death had prompted this whole business, had rather been forgotten in the inquiry. The inquiry centred, as I say, largely on the government and the BBC, and poor old Dr. Kelly didn't feature very much at all. There then appeared a number of letters from eminent and highly qualified medical experts in The Guardian and other newspapers disputing the suggestion that David Kelly could have died in the way that Lord Hutton described, and suggesting, in fact, it was clinically impossible for him to have done so. Those letters worried me, and I began to look into the matter. And the more I looked into the matter, the more concerned I became. I subsequently wrote an article for the Mail on Sunday in July, I think, that year, 2004, and it generated the biggest response of anything I've ever done in politics. About 1,000 people contacted me by email, letter, telephone. All bar two were supportive of the concern I expressed and urged me to go on with my investigations. The public clearly weren't convinced by Lord Hutton as far as David Kelly was concerned. And as you've heard, I took some time out from my party's front bench when the opportunity arose to look into the matter, and the result is this book, The Strange Death of David Kelly. Let me now turn to the events surrounding David Kelly directly from July 2003. David Kelly had been cleared over a long period of time by the Foreign Office, though less so by the Ministry of Defence. He occupied a curious position of really acting for the Foreign Office, but being technically line managed by the Ministry of Defence. He'd been cleared by the Foreign Office to engage in discussions with journalists, to give off-the-record briefings, and this had gone back many years. And therefore, for him to meet Andrew Gilligan, as he did at the Charing Cross Hotel, was not out of the ordinary. And he gave him background information, not for direct attribution. What changed, of course, was that the allegation that the government had deliberately sexed up the dossier was highly charged and went to the heart of the case for the Iraq War and the government's behaviour. It was a charge which has essentially proven to be correct subsequently. Anyway, when that was first broadcast, Alistair Campbell and those around him went ballistic and declared war on the BBC and sent large numbers of letters to the BBC on a kind of hourly basis demanding apologies and retractions and everything else. Part of the strategy was to then, I think, involve David Kelly on the government side, whether he wanted to be involved or not. He had gone to the Ministry of Defence to say, I think I might be responsible for this story, inadvertently or otherwise. There was then a decision taken, and the evidence for that is in the book, that there was a meeting involving Blair and Jeff Hoon, at which it was deliberately decided to leak Dr. Kelly's name, or force it out, in order that he could be used as a pawn in the battle between the government and the BBC. Not a very edifying way to deal with a public servant who'd done immense good for his country and for the world, but that was what was decided by those politicians. Subsequently, then, he was outed, thanks to Jeff Hood and others, and that led to his appearance at the Foreign Affairs Committee on the 16th of July 2003, when he faced a difficult time. He wasn't used to the public gaze in that sense, and he was treading a fine line between not making matters worse, I think, in terms of what he said to Andrew Gilligan, while not lying, obviously, to MPs in that session. Now let me give you the official version of events, as Lord Hutton will describe it. The events of that particular committee meeting were harrowing for David Kelly, so Lord Hutton will tell us. He wasn't used to that. He came away thinking his career was at an end. He was very depressed. He then spent a couple of days mulling over it, and on the Thursday, he left his house for the last time, carrying with him his boyhood knife and 30 coproximal tablets, with the intention of slitting his wrist, taking the tablets either to aid death or to deal with the pain of the wrist slitting, and there he passed quietly away on Harrowdown Hill. That explanation is wrong in virtually all regards. Let me deal with his mood first of all, and his mood is, if you like, circumstantial. It's not possible to always be inside someone's mind, but insofar as we can tell what was in his mind, he was certainly not suicidal. First of all, those I've spoken to who know him very well, including UN weapons inspectors, colleagues, close friends, those who live in his village, Orr will absolutely state that he was the last person in the world to commit suicide. He had dealt with very harsh and difficult episodes, including revealing, forcing out details of an illegal bioweapons program by the Soviet Union / Russia, and indeed the Iraqis in the early 1990s. He was not the person to be intimidated by a bunch of MPs. However, that you might say that we don't know whether that's really what he was like. That's not proof, and I accept that. He went to the Intelligence and Security Committee the next day, on the Wednesday. This is generally not known, but I've got the transcript from that meeting. He gave evidence there. He was in much better form, even cracking jokes. And on the Thursday, the last day of his life, he was sending emails to friends saying the worst was over, how he was looking forward to getting back to Iraq, and he actually spoke to the Ministry of Defense and booked a flight to Iraq the following Thursday. Emails were sent at 11:18, shortly before he left the house for the last time. In addition to that, his wife was ill in bed that lunchtime, and his daughter was about to be married. So it had to be a particularly selfish act, I think, for him to have gone to commit suicide at that point. And all the evidence, circumstantial evidence, on his mood suggests that that was a highly unlikely action for him to have taken. However, that is not definitively proven one way or the other. What is much more difficult to rebut is the clear evidence which can be accumulated concerning the alleged method of death.
Norman Baker, MP there, talking 2 weekends ago about his investigation into the strange death of David Kelly. The book of the same title is available from all good bookshops, as well as the film is Talk, which is available from www.thealternativeview.co.uk. And you can also see avtv.info.
BCFM 93.2 FM. Your choice, your voice.
Well, I'd like to introduce the Bard of Windmill Hill once again to our studio. He's got a couple of things to promote, and he's going to read us a poem. Hello.
Hello, hello. Great to be here. What's two events to promote. 4th of December, we've got Derek Robinson.
Okay.
This is a little quote from Venue. If there were any justice, Derek Robinson would be recognised as a Grade 1 listed civic treasure. He made his name for himself doing Brizzle books.
Okay.
He's the originator of the original Brizzle books, although other people have copied them. He started that off. But his main thing is historical novels.
Right.
This is another quote. Full of telling research and sharp insight. It is also mordantly funny and, in its way, as loud an anti-battle cry as Catch-22.
Wow. Okay. So is he doing some live speaking, a live speaking
yes,
event?
Yes, he's going to come along and do a presentation, and then he will be interviewed and talk about his inspirations.
Brilliant. Okay, where's that?
And that is at Circles Bookshop on North Street on the 4th of December. You can get tickets from Circles or call me to make reservations if you're interested on 966-5514.
Brilliant. Okay.
So that's that one. And then on the 10th and 11th of December, we have the Christmas Lansdowne Cabaret.
Brilliant. At the Lansdowne Pub.
At the Lansdowne Pub.
Okay.
Clifton Road. Which features the intoxicating hilarity of Darren Hoskins, the wit and word wizardry of the Bard of Windmill Hill, the surreal magical essence of Magical Simon, the mesmerising manipulations of Girls in Hats. This incredible cornucopia of entertaining extravagance will be compared and immeasurably enhanced by the inimitable, the intoxicating, the intangibly incredible, the modestly magnificent Matt Pang.
Okay, and that's the Lansdowne Pub and Clifton.
So again, yeah, just give me a call on that number, 966-5514, if anybody would like to make reservations.
Fantastic. Have you brought some poetry for us at all?
So I do, yes. Of course, the main thing in the news is Afghanistan.
As always.
So this is my latest rumination on Afghanistan. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, our leaders say they have a plan to bring peace to your troubled land and get rid of the Taliban. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, O deathbed of the Russian bear. And now our sons are dying there to get rid of the Taliban. The Taliban are bad, bad men. Our soldiers never will know when they'll meet their end to serve the plan to get rid of the Taliban. Afghanistan is old and wild. Some think that it cannot be styled to meet the purpose of the plan for a westernized Afghanistan. The Taliban don't want us there. That's why they killed the Russian bear. They killed the bear. They kill the Brits. They blast their enemies to bits. Who are told they must be calm and brave and always be non-partisan and be prepared to meet their grave to help promote the Western plan. And in the plan, the world will be made safe for our democracy. So then Afghanistan will see that they too can be truly free. Afghanistan, Afghanistan, our leaders still believe their plan, though a hydra-headed monster can disrupt the plans of Western man. Afghanistan is old and wild, where democracy's a foreign child who offends the native Taliban, who do not want the Western plan. We must defeat the monster there, or else its tentacles will spread. All nations must take on their share until the Taliban are dead. Brown and Obama say we must not leave until the war is won. They say we must extend our trust to end the rule of bomb and gun. But Afghanistan is old and wild, and democracy's a Western child. And we wonder whether this child can bring peace to wild Afghanistan.
Thank you very much. And how recently did you write that?
I wrote that a few days ago.
Yeah. Excellent. The very excellent booming rhetoric and poetry of the Bard of Wimble Hill. And may we have more of you in future weeks.
I'm sure I'll be back. Looking forward to it. Yeah. Thank you.
Jess Sparks is here with the latest in What's On in Bristol and a song of the week.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is a What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Thursday, 3rd of December, and there's not just one big name group coming to Bristol, but three. Gunfire 76, which features Wednesday 13 of Murder Dolls fame, will be performing with support from Bullets and Octane at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Also on 3rd of December, Living Colour will be performing at the Tunnels, which is at Bristol and Exeter Mews near to Temple Mead Station in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £14 in advance and £18 on the door. And finally on 3rd of December, New York Dolls will be performing with support at the Anson Rooms in Queens Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £19.50 in advance. Moving on to Friday, 4th of December, Blackfire will be performing at the Reckless Engineer in Bristol. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. On to a Song of the Week, and I feature Bellowhead. This group formed in 2004 and to date have released two albums. This is from their first album, Burlesque, which was released in 2006, and is the track Jordan.
Travel, I believe. your sweets. Jordan is a hard road to travel, I believe. And John spent 3 days in the belly of a whale. 3 days and 2 nights in a cording. He tickled him with a straw, which caused him to laugh. And he shunted him on the other side of Jordan. Pull off your overcoat and roll up your sleeves. To travel, I believe. Pull off your old coat and roll up your sleeves. Jordan is a hard road to travel, I believe.
That was Bellowhead with the track Jordan from the album Burlesque. For more information, you can check out www.bellowhead.co.uk. Into Saturday, 5th of December, Sinner Boy, who are a tribute to Rory Gallagher, will be performing at The Furnace, which is at 73 Commercial Road in Swindon. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £7 in advance and £10 on the door. On Sunday, 6th of December, Goldie Looking Chain will be performing with support from 88 at the Thecla in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. Earlier tonight, I received news that Area 81 Rock Club in Lawrence Hill, Bristol has closed down. Despite all the hard work the owners have put in over the years, the reason they closed was lack of support from the public. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Oh, thank you very much, Jeff. Last winter, two Bristol drivers took aid to Gaza. 1 year on, Gaza is still under siege. Eagle-eyed listeners will remember we had Mohammed El Haddad, the head of the UK Arabic Society, in the studio to chat to us about his trip. We heard about his journey en route. Israel and Egypt are denying even the necessities of life to people in Gaza, so a second Viva Palestina convoy is planned for this December. A 44-ton truck loaded with medical aid will leave Bristol on the 4th of December. To show support for the Palestinians, please turn up on the 4th of December to see the convoy depart from outside the Council House on College Green, so that's right in the city centre, at 10 a.m. We are calling on all musicians and politicians to be there on the 4th of December to publicise the departure as much as possible. The Viva Palestina convoy also needs vital funds for the project, and you can donate online at a slightly complicated web address, http://bglink.ning.com. So I think if you just put bglink.ning.com, just that will be fine. And the website, slightly easier, bristolgazalink.org. I've got some times here for the 4th of December, 10 to 11 a.m. if you sort of convene there on College Green. At 11 to 12 a.m. there'll be a parade across town to Easton, and at 12 to 2 p.m. Prayers at the Shah Jalal Jain Mosque. That's 468 to 470 Stapleton Road, BS5 6PE.
Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Show. Studio guests were Michael Doble, chairman of the Thomas Chatterton Society, Malcolm Greaves reading a collection of poems by Chatterton, and another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary. The features were by the very appealing Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. Studio engineer was Johnny Royden, and the What's On was by Jeff Sparks. The producer was John Peters Coleman. It's goodbye from me, Katie Austin.
And from myself, John Peters Coleman.
Until next time, adieu.